This is Self-Work, and I'm Dr. Margaret Rutherford. At Self-Work, we discuss psychological and emotional issues and what you can do about them, whether that's learning self-acceptance, taking action, or seeking therapy or treatment. 8 years ago, I extended the walls of my practice to reach those of you who might already be knowledgeable about mental health treatment, but also to those of you who might say you'd never darken the door of a therapist. And yet, you are here. I'll answer your questions while I invite you to take a few minutes for your own self-work.
I always acknowledge that there was a lot of darkness because I don't want to ever meet people in a place that's not accessible. Right. And there was so much darkness. I mean, I've alluded to this in the book, but just for your listeners, I mean, several days, weeks, months to your point where I was incredibly depressed or angry. I mean, it's a version of the grieving process. I was grieving the loss of a life that I knew. I was grieving the loss of an able body.
Welcome to this week's edition of Self-Work. Perspective is a gift, but most of us gain our perspective from years of living and learning. Many might say that perspective is part of wisdom. Some lucky people don't have much really go wrong in their lives, at least nothing major. Many more have some kind of tragedy occur, the early death of a parent, an illness that devastates your life or the life of someone you love. But not too many people have two catastrophic medical conditions to cope with, and certainly not two that occurred in the span of a decade. Lindsay Roy had just that. At age 31, she was named vice president at Hallmark Cards, one of the youngest in the company's more than 100-year history. But her life was abruptly transformed 5 years later, so she was 36, when she was nearly killed in a boating accident, left with an amputated left leg and severe limb injuries, and facing a long and difficult recovery. She was determined not to just heal, but to emerge stronger. Now get this. 8 years post that accident, finally really thriving, Lindsay confronted the unexpected again. She was diagnosed with a rare and progressive disease that destroyed the blood vessels in her lungs, requiring a double lung transplant. This profound setback challenged her to actively shift her viewpoint in order to discover whatever she could about some sort of hidden advantage of her situation and to learn about resilience. She's a sought-after speaker, imparting these hard-won lessons to help you adapt, persevere, and innovate in your own life. And The Gift of Perspective is her first book. I'll also have in the show notes for you the link to her incredible and very moving TEDx. So let's get right to her interview. I introduce you to Lindsay Roy. Welcome to Self-Work, Lindsay. I'm so glad to have you on. And I saw your TEDx and I read your book, and I'm really thrilled that you have chosen very purposefully to use what has happened to you in such a meaningful and what's the word I want to use? Not even purposeful. It's like, I was thinking about it this morning. You've had some real loss. It's not like you're saying, oh, that's a gift in this sort of Hallmark-y kind of way. But you definitely are saying there are gifts from it that I've been able to understand. So I tell Self-Work listeners your story, and I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. You know, and just I'll start off really quickly where you were going there, which is, it's like, how do you find those diamonds in the rubble, you know, or whatever metaphor you want to use, because things will happen, and how do you look for the gems? But anyway, to that point, so the quick answer on my story, and I will preface this by saying, I know we all have a story, and I believe we should all share our stories, but my story is, when I was 36 years old, I was in a freak boating accident that resulted in an amputation of my left leg and several other injuries. And then fast forward about
significant injuries.
Yeah. My right leg, the one that was not amputated, is, missing about half of the volume below the knee, but it works. So fast forward 10 years later, I'd gotten used to being an amputee, walking with the prosthetic leg, all of those kinds of things. And at that point I was diagnosed with a rare autoimmune disease that caused a rare condition that led to really the unfortunate destruction of my lungs. And now I am about 2 years past that and a very, very grateful recipient of a double lung transplant. So
you're only two years past that. You're only two years past that. I didn't realize that. Wow.
Yeah, it's still pretty recent.
Yeah, I didn't, for some reason. So did you start writing the book and then sort of re-edit it or redo it because of the, also losing your lungs?
Yes, I had the publishing deal done. I was about halfway through the book, just really reflecting on what I've learned from my accident and essentially becoming, you know, instantly quote unquote disabled. Right. And when the lung, news happened, I talked to my publisher and we delayed the book a year and I went through all the steps I needed to go through. But then I really decided that, gosh, you know, I'd learned so much because when I was writing the book initially, I was several years past that, like, trauma when you're in the thick of it. And I really truly had to take my own medicine. It was like life was imitating art. And so I had these kind of fresh insights of like, it's easy to say it when you're kind of through it. It's very different to say it when you're in the middle of it. And so I actually think it made the book a lot stronger. And so from hospital beds and writing notes on my phone and just those kind of cathartic moments, I finished the book and I think it made it a lot stronger. My joke always is God looked at the book and said, that's not really good enough yet. I think you need some more content. But it definitely has some more content now.
I'm respectful of the humor, certainly, which of course is a lifesaver in many ways. But, you know, yes, Lindsay, I cannot imagine that you didn't have moments, days, months of, hey, what's going on? Why me? I mean, what am I walking around with a big target on my head? I mean, certainly your book is so positive. It really is. It's, and I've written several things down I want to talk to you about, but I do want to touch on the idea of, because I think you make a purposeful, you say in the book, I'm really not going to spend a lot of time talking about the down days. I'm not going to talk a lot about the despondency or so whatever. And I noted that note self. And yet I have, as a psychologist, as someone who knows that people who listen to this are also going to say, but how did you get through the darkness? What would you say?
Yeah, well, first of all, to your point, I always acknowledge that there was a lot of darkness because I don't want to ever meet people in a place that's not accessible. Right. And there was so much darkness. I mean, I've alluded to this in the book, but just for your listeners, I mean, several days, weeks, months, to your point, where I was incredibly depressed or angry. I mean, it's a version of the grieving process. I was grieving the loss of a life that I knew. I was grieving the loss of an able body. Mm-hmm. And I went through all of those steps. I mean, after my amputation, when I couldn't even, you know, move out of my own bed, let alone do all the things I was used to, I distinctly remember banging my fist and just saying, oh my gosh, why did this happen to me? You know, or going through all the coulda, woulda, shoulda. It's like, oh, if I wouldn't have been here, if I wouldn't have been there, we wouldn't have planned this trip. So for sure. And then in the very, I distinctly remember dark days of winter, the year after my amputation, just not even wanting to eat a bite of food or do anything really. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, all of that is very real. And during my lung journey, even though it was in a lot of ways harder because it was much more life-threatening, I felt like a lot stronger. And I think that is heavily because of increased faith, but also increased resilience. Mm-hmm. I had built up some resilience muscle. So with all of that, to acknowledge, first of all, I have been in every dark situation. But I will say that how I got through it, I mean, there's not one single answer to that, as you read in the book. There's a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But in general, I would say my answer is I kept striving to try out new things. I kept an open mind. I was very into trial and error of maybe this will work. Maybe this physical therapy will work. Literally different therapies of chiropractic care. I went to counseling. I tried antidepressants. I tried
reading books. Acupuncture. You tried
acupuncture. I mean, I tried thinking about every day, like, you know, what are five ways this could be worse? I mean, I unpack once again all that and unpack those things in my book. But my biggest meta theme on it, I think, is I just kept trying. And some days I would take a day off. Some days, or sometimes I would take a week off and just wallow. But I kept trying different things. And I will tell you, 9 out of 10 things didn't sustain me or didn't work. But when you find one that does, that's the nugget. And those are the things that I've written down.
So you tell in the book, you tell the story about Amy Purdy, who is, she's some kind of sports. I mean, she's been a Paralympics or something.
Yeah. She's a snowboarder.
Yes. Snowboarder. That's right.
And now she's a professional dancing, motivational speaker. Yeah.
Dancing with the Stars. And she had her own TEDx. And you use the quote, I borrowed perspective.
Yes.
And I that caught my ear and my eye, because sometimes when I have a patient in front of me and they'll just say, I just don't feel hopeful. I can't find any hope. And I'll look at them, and this isn't in the first session. This is something obviously I say after I get to know them a little bit more, but I said, well, you can borrow mine. Mm-hmm. You can borrow my hope. And I thought, oh, this is somewhat like that.
For sure.
So what do you mean by that? And how did you borrow perspective from Amy Purdy?
Yes, yes. I love that you use that phrase, borrowing hope. I might steal that from you too.
Sure, please do.
on the borrowing perspective, to me, that's really just looking at someone else who's in a similar situation and seeing what their quote unquote movie looks like an hour and a half in, even though you might be 10 minutes in. And to me, that's really what it is. You know, I, as you mentioned, the word Hallmark, you know, I've been at Hallmark, worked there for 24 years.
Oh, that's right. I didn't make that connection right there.
Yeah, exactly. But on that note, as we used to talk about this inside a lot, and you know, sometimes still do, of gone before. So if you're a mother of adults and I'm a new mother, you've gone before me and you can give me some insight. If someone has lost a spouse before, they have gone before your journey and they can give you some insight that no one else can. And borrowing perspective is related to that, where find somebody, even if it's not your exact situation, there's rare situations, but there's some generality to them. And to be able to see how someone can come from a place of darkness and destruction and rubble and trauma or whatever, and see that they have found a way through, I found that super hope-inducing, super cathartic. And Amy Purdy, for those of you who don't know, you know, became a double amputee at the age of 19. And I, you know, researched her. And it was also in a place where I didn't want to go to support groups. I didn't want to talk to people. And so from the safety of my own home and my phone and my computer and the internet, I found pictures of her laying in a bed with bulky prosthetic legs next to her and just hating life. And then I fast forward and saw a TED talk where she gracefully walked around on a stage with these really cool looking legs. Mm. That to me was borrowing perspective, borrowing a new viewpoint of my current situation. And it was everything to me when I needed it.
You know, something that I've discovered with people who have these sorts of traumatic losses is that, you know, they may find a support group, but often they'll say, Margaret, I just can't do it. And the answer frequently is because I'm trying to deal with my own.
Yes. Loss.
And to be supportive of other people, although there's a part of me that would like to be, mm-hmm. and not in a selfish way. It's just, I don't know what to say because I am so trying to survive what has happened to me. I just don't have it to give. And so they feel sort of, so they say back off from the support groups. And I love this idea of what you're saying is that you can still get that support in a way where if you look for people who, you know, you think, I love your analogy of they're further along in the movie than I am.
Yeah.
So, so I can see more where I'm going.
For sure. For sure. I think the other thing too about those online support groups or in-person support groups or Zoom call support groups, I feel like I get invited to a lot of these things in the different clubs I'm a member of now. Mm-hmm. And the reality too, for those of you who felt this way, I'll just say it out loud. Sometimes you're not ready to be in that club yet. Like I wasn't ready to go to Amputee Coalition of America or whatever. 10 years in, I go to those kinds of things and I try to help people, but you don't have to be ready right away. Mm-hmm. And or the lung groups I get invited to, sometimes I'm not ready to hear all of the negative things that people are experiencing. It just takes me backwards in the movie. And so I protect and shield myself from those things. Mm-hmm. And so those are all normal things to be feeling. And that doesn't mean you don't care about other people. I now, at different points in my journey, wrote the book to help other people. I do speaking events to try to help other people. I call people who I know are on the transplant list or whatever. So different things for different seasons. But there are times when you just have to acknowledge that thing is not right for you.
This leads me to another quote you said, and I think you may be quoting someone else, but I liked it. It says, sharing doesn't have to come from an open wound.
Yes.
And I love that because it also speaks to the idea that, you know, when you're in that place where you're just doing everything you can to stay positive or to find some sort of reason to stay alive the next hour or two or three or four, then, you know, it's very important to remember that, you know, how and when you start sharing and trying to help other people is very important. You know, the story that you told that brought tears to my eyes was when you were talking about what you had to go through to put your children to bed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could see you doing that. I could see how all of us who are lucky enough to be mothers would automatically know what you were talking about. Not that every bedtime is wonderful.
And, right. That's, you know, reality.
It's fairy dust. I mean, it doesn't, but the fact that other people were doing it and you weren't, I thought, oh my gosh, that would be so hard. I mean, at least emotionally hard. So can you tell that story a little bit?
For sure. For sure. So the story that you're referencing is one that happened early on in me, you know, having to deal with these kinds of things. And it happened, you know, call it 6 to 8 weeks after I was out of the hospital home for my first story, the amputation story. Mm-hmm. And our house has kids' bedrooms are upstairs. Our master bedroom's on the main floor. Our primary bedroom is right there by the living room. And I was in, at that time, even a hospital bed in my living room on the main floor in a wheelchair, couldn't move, whatnot. And my kids were just 2 and 4. When I lost my leg and was dealing with severe injuries of, you know, 3 of my 4 limbs. So I couldn't really do anything physically to help them. And I definitely couldn't get upstairs. So we tried a lot of things. I was used to putting them to bed at night. And, you know, that was part of our routine. And so now we're finally somewhat back to normal. I'm not in the hospital. I'm home. And they want me to put them to bed. Yeah. And I would lay in the living room. And we have this kind of like catwalk area of the way our house is. So I could hear them, you know, asking my husband for mom or mommy or whatever. My mom would be here, my mother-in-law, and they just wanted me. I'd been gone a lot in the hospital and let alone our old routine. And it would kill me. It was like 1,000 little knives to my heart. I would just sob. So we would have them come down or sleep in our room, you know, all the stuff that wasn't sustainable. And so finally one day I was like, you know what? Enough of this. And I didn't tell anybody I was going to do it. My arms were healed enough that I could use my arms. So I wheeled myself over in my wheelchair. I put it in park and I just basically dumped myself out of my wheelchair on the stair landing, just sort of fell. And I had a lot of injuries that were healing. So it wasn't maybe the wisest move.
No, but it was determined.
It was motherhood determination. And so I learned that I could crawl up the stairs because I had no prosthetic leg at this time. I literally was missing half a leg and the other leg was all wrapped up in all these wound care, you know, supplies. And so I crawled up the stairs backwards on 2 barely, you know, working arms.
Your crab talk.
I called it the crab crawl. So imagine, viewers, if you will, arms behind you on the stairs. It looked like how a crab would crawl backwards. Yeah. So my kids started to do it and we would do this little thing. We'd say, crab crawling, we're crawling crabs. We had this song because I tried to make things normal for a 2 and a 4-year-old. Mm-hmm. And I would crawl into my daughter's room. I'm actually in that room right now. It's converted to my office. I would sit right here where I am right now in this chair, rock her to sleep, and I would text my husband and he would put her in her crib. Like I said, she was just 2. Then I would hoist myself down, crawl down the hall, and I would lie in my son's little twin bed. And I cannot tell you that would fill my heart with joy in a day that was mostly depressed, mostly getting new bandages, at home nursing, going to therapy that was horrible. But those 45 minutes, hour and a half of the day, I would feel such joy. And it was because I just didn't give up and I found a way. You're just so resourceful when your back's against the wall.
It was, I mean, even listening to you, I get a little teary because it's just so meaningful. So let's take a break and we'll be back in just a moment. When my mom talked about menopause, she called it the change, and it was all very hush-hush, as if there was something wrong about something so natural. Thank goodness with mental health awareness and actual research, we're beginning to understand the huge role hormones play in women's bodies. Being postmenopausal has its challenges, but if you're going through either perimenopause or menopause, then I suggest you try Hormone Harmony. Why? Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now here's the beauty about them. They help the body adapt to stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code SELFWORK at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code SELFWORK for 15% off today. So you also, you quote Brené Brown a good deal about daring greatly, and then the whole Teddy Roosevelt quote about the man in the arena. What did you find out about the true meaning for you of resilience?
Mm-hmm. Well, I believe, as I do state in the book, first of all, resilience is like immunity. At some point, you got to build it, and it's better when you do, even though it is not fun to go through that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you send your kids out into the world, they're going to get colds, they're going to get the flu, they're going to get the stomach bugs. That's just how it works. But then they become stronger and stronger. And I think resilience is the same thing, that you go through things in life, whether that's middle school troubles with your best friends when you're 12, or that's learning to be homesick when you go away for the first time from your family, or whatever it is. There's different types of resilience. Mm-hmm. And then there's these deep, incredible loss, medical trauma, personal trauma, whatever factors and chapters of your life that build deep resilience. So first of all, I do believe that that's just part of life, is building resilience. But what it means to me is just that muscle that you build that allows you to take a step forward when you don't think you can. If it's crawling, if it's inching, if it's fingernails, you know, in the sand, mm-hmm. that's resilience to me. And mm-hmm. over time, you just become better at it. That doesn't mean it's easy, but you do find a way to just keep moving forward, even if it's, once again, a centimeter at a time.
You know, this is a very practical question.
Sure.
But how do you handle it when people, because I was thinking about the story you told about the beach and going, you know, that people ended helping you and were staring at you the first day. And then you told that in your TEDx, I think, too.
Yeah.
How do you handle the stares you get? How do you mm-hmm. handle this sense of, ooh, you know, I'm glad that's not me? I mean, how do you handle that?
Yeah. Well, for the you know, viewers or listeners, think about when I walk around with shorts as an example, which yeah. I am now because it's warm. My left leg has basically a metal rod halfway up to my knee, and then a black, almost like neoprene sleeve that goes up mid-thigh. My ankle looks like a black piece of metal. And so that's unique looking in and of itself.
Yep.
My right leg is probably even more jarring to people. I tell people it looks like a shark took a bite out of me because, you know, that's the propeller is, you know, the boat propeller in the accident I've referenced, you know, hit me in several spots. And on my right leg, I'm missing 6 inches of my fibula, a tendon, and about half of the mass, as I kind of referenced earlier. So mm-hmm. that leg has been grafted with my own skin and, you know, has had all kinds of things. And so it looks not super appealing, but it is what it is. And so
it looks like
around,
a scarred up leg. I mean,
it looks like a scarred up leg. Yes.
I believe it or not, had a friend who also had that kind of accident in a boat. And I can remember mm-hmm. talking about this.
Yeah, exactly. So my legs, you know, have unique looks. And this is an area where I feel like a lot of times I can tell people I've been in pain. I've been depressed, et cetera. This is an area that honestly has really never bothered me. And it doesn't really bother me when people look at me, you know, or ask questions or give me the side eye. I guess I'm just a person that at this point in my life, I'm like, you know, I'm just happy to be able to function. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say I don't notice it. I mean, even just yesterday, I was at this volleyball event with my daughter and I had shorts on and I've been wearing pants all mm-hmm. winter long. And there's hundreds of people there and I'm walking through, you know, big crowd of people and I can just feel the eyes.
Right.
And you just feel them. But it doesn't really bother me, though I do notice it. Kids will comment on it. Adults are very awkward about it. They just look and then look away when they see you looking. But practically, I don't know. That's something that isn't a thing to me, though I'm sure it'd be a thing to a lot of people.
How old are your kids now?
Almost 15. My son will be 15 on Saturday. My daughter just turned 13. So, okay.
And how do they handle it, given them their teenage-ness?
Yeah. You know, I think for the most part, they're used to it. And, you know, that's, I guess, a blessing of them being so little when all this happened to me is that's just their reality. And their friends know me, you know, in that way. I will say the recency of me having to wear a mask in public, like I said, my lung transplant is less than 2 years old. And so I am immunocompromised. Obviously, my lungs are very precious to me. And so it's very, very, very important when I am inside and indoors and around people, I wear a mask always. If I go to the grocery store, mask. Go to a basketball game with them, mask. When I'm outside, thankfully, I don't have to wear one. But I feel like that honestly bothers them a little more because they're
like
not
the pandemic
used
hasn't
to it.
Ended for them. Yeah,
exactly. And so like even yesterday, my son was like, no, kind of, because I try not to freak them out with all the worry stuff. But he's like, so why do you still wear a mask? You know, so I can tell that bothers them a little bit, but I just answer it and they just deal with it and move on. I remember when I was on oxygen. So before my lung transplant, I had to be on the, call my granny green oxygen tanks. I mean, just to be very real. It was like the big old school green tank because I had to have that much oxygen. I couldn't have something more discreet and I'd have to push it around on a little cart. I remember one day my daughter essentially told me, hey, you can just wait in the car to pick me up. And I knew then that it bothered her and rightfully so. That's very jarring to see a 40 something year old woman walking around pushing an oxygen cart. And we had a heart to heart about that. So for them, there are moments when it's a little weird, but by and large, you know, like me, they just deal with it.
What I was also amazed by, let's talk about your lung transplant a little bit, is a double lung transplant, by the way.
Yes.
It actually happened very quickly. You got on the list. And I mean, I know you carrying around that oxygen tank seemed like forever, but
yeah,
I'm sure. I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. But the transplant, so what was that like to realize that, did you know anything about the donor? Did you know anything about that whole process?
Yeah. To your point, it went incredibly quickly. So I was diagnosed with my lung condition in December of 21, and I had the transplant in July of 22. So from not even knowing anything was wrong with my lungs outside of some symptoms that people couldn't figure out, doctors couldn't figure out, to actually receiving the lung transplant was literally, you know, 7 months. So it was so fast. I think even still being less than 2 years into it, it's such a blur to me that I think I'm still processing it, to be really honest. With that said, like the amputation, I'd never even really thought about prosthetics. I mean, I thought about like the Oscar Pistorius in the Olympics with his little blade. Obviously, that's a whole other story. Same with lung transplant. I didn't know anybody that had a lung transplant. I mean, you hear kidney transplants and liver transplants, but the lung thing, I don't even know if I knew existed. But all of a sudden, it was smacked in my face, and there I was on the circuit. Going to different institutions, you have to have a hospital that basically accepts you. You can't just like go on the list on your own. You have to have a hospital who will list you.
Okay.
And so I was on the circuit and doing test after test after test after test, horribly invasive and uncomfortable test. And then when you go to a new hospital, they want to do all the same tests
again.
All
the same thing. Yeah.
All the same things again. So I was here, I was there, I was everywhere, begging and pleading and praying that somebody would take me and accept me. And so it was just, you were just in it so quickly that I didn't even have time to think about it. But thankfully, I got accepted. I got on the list. And then my condition was so extreme. I mean, I was told at one appointment about a month before my transplant, like, hey, you can go home. You don't have to be in the hospital for the next few weeks, but you could, frankly, just drop dead at any moment. I mean, I was told those things.
Oh my gosh.
And of course, their language was nicer, but that's what I heard. And so I was so lucky to be put towards the top of the list because my condition was so severe. And then there was also a lot of blessings. Like I am 5'9". So for a lung transplant, you get evaluated on your height because it's all about the length of your lung capacity, basically like the cavity of your chest and then your blood type. I have a very common blood type and then your antibody profile. And they told me, hey, you're going to develop more antibodies if you've given birth, check. If you've had a blood transfusion, check because of my leg accident and a few other things. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be challenging on that. And lo and behold, another miracle. I had low antibodies. And so I was an average height. It doesn't matter the gender. So I'm an average height for men and women. So anyway, that really helped, plus the condition of that I had. And so speaking of then the donor, you know, my angel that I try to thank every day, if not multiple times a day, mm-hmm. all I know is that he was a 39-year-old male. I have written a letter, a card, of course, working at Hallmark. I wrote a card to the family. It's an anonymous kind of closed adoption-like process. And I wrote a card with my gratitude, and it's their choice if we ever get to know each other. And I haven't heard from them, which I highly respect. I don't know what their mm-hmm. walk and journey has been, but I just wanted to have the chance to thank them. So all I know is a 39-year-old male.
Wow. It's just incredible. And you know, you have other quotes from other people, Michael J. Fox, and the best way out is always through. What a lot of people say is that that's not the way they remember the quote. It's one way out or something, but it's the best.
Right, the only way out of the best way out.
Only way out is always through. And as you said, the best way out is always through. So here's my final question.
Sure.
Well, first, let me show your book. It's called The Gift of Perspective. Sure.
Isn't it pretty?
It is.
Of course,
pretty.
I love the cover. Yeah.
It is beautiful. It is beautiful. As you look around your relationships, we've already talked about your kids, with your husband, with your friends, with your job. How has this changed how you see yourself, or how you see the future? Maybe would be a good question.
Well, I think our life experiences, and you obviously know this in your line of work, shape how we see everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm no different. And that the reason the word perspective is in the title of my book, the reason the word perspective I used over and over in my TED talk, is because I truly believe, you know, how you see your circumstances are more important than the circumstances themselves.
Yes.
And so I have worked so hard to change, alter, shift, depending on the day and what mode I'm in, or even appreciate the viewpoint I have in that moment. Because I've learned time and time again that that's key. And I remember when I went to counseling, learning that, you know, your circumstances are less than 10% of your happiness. It's all about how you see things. And so I've worked so, so hard to see things. And I, because of that, you know, I see everything differently. And I can get caught in my old habits and old ruts when times are good. And I go through a stretch of 3 months, 6 months, 2 weeks where things are quote unquote not as traumatic or not as hard. I find myself falling into the same old patterns of worrying about dumb stuff. I mean, that's just human nature, but there's also a gift in that when you're not worried about life or death things. I mean, that's a hard place to live every day, but it's changed how I see everything. And I remind myself of those things too. And I don't take things for granted nearly as much as I did before all of this. Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
I think the quote you say in the book is hardship is subjective.
Yes.
And I, as a therapist for 30 years, I've certainly seen people probably at their most demoralized, and they really don't know. It's a lot of the reasons why they come to therapy. And, one of the things, Lindsay, that I believe about therapists is that we're sort of conduits between the people that we've seen in the past that have gone through hardship, and then this person sitting in front of us, and I can tell them what I learned from watching this person go through it. And
yes,
so that's that
borrowed perspective.
More perspective, right? Borrowing perspective. And I feel like sometimes that's one of my major roles with people, is to help them see you're really not alone. Even though right now you may be feeling it's your child that's died, or it's your divorce, or it's you were raped, or tornadoes, you know, went through your house, or you're in a boat accident. It's still, there are other people that know how you feel. And yet, like you say, what you tell yourself about something is so important. And, you know, your whole book is full of that sort of conduit. I think you want people to learn through your experience and take hope through your experience. And I would thoroughly recommend someone, especially who's going through something they never expected, to pick it up. It's called The Gift of Perspective.
Thank you. Thank you. I really genuinely appreciate that. And I love that. I'm going to take that with me today. That's exactly right. I have a rope visual I use when I do my presentations, and it talks about how you can get from one side to the other when that rope breaks. And it's a conduit. I love that metaphor. Thank you.
You're so welcome. Thank you for being on Self Work.
Thank you.
Of course, I want to thank you for being here. You know, I love the way that Lindsay talked about how she really, especially rose to the occasion when she was trying to get back the simple things in her life, like putting her children to bed. And I can only hope, as I'm sure you can, that I would have the same kind of courage that she has shown. I'm not sure sometimes. One never knows. But I would hope that I would have it. Don't forget, we have a new giveaway for you. If you subscribe to drmargaretrutherford.com, and that's just an easy email thing, then you get a free copy of my latest ebook, which is called What's Your Protective Shield? And it talks all about your own defense mechanisms or your defensive behaviors, how you keep painful emotions away. And you can learn a little bit about yourself, about how you built that shield. Not saying it's a negative thing. It's often very positive. It's just when you're using it a bit too much that it can be a problem. We're going to be heading into our 9th year of self-work here pretty soon in the fall. I cannot believe it. So especially if you've been here from the very beginning or you've just joined us recently, thank you. You can join my Facebook group at facebook.com/group/self-work. You can buy some self-work merchandise to really help support this podcast. And the link to that will be in your show notes. You can get a cup or a mug or a sweatshirt, even a tote. Kind of let other people know you're doing your self-work. Of course, you can always ask and share self-work with your friends. And then subscribe where you listen. That also boosts self-work. Thank you again for being here. Please take care of yourself, your loved ones, and your community. I'm Dr. Margaret, and this has been Self-Work.